Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Dr. Amy Moore. As a cognitive psychologist, counselor, and former teacher of teachers, Amy has spent the last three decades helping parents and educators meet the needs of children in their lives while also caring for themselves. She began teaching in 1994 as a pre-K teacher and was also a curriculum coordinator. After around 20 years as an educator, she became a psychologist. Dr. Amy Moore is currently a cognitive psychologist at LearningRx in Colorado Springs at the headquarters of the largest network of cognitive training centers in the world. She specializes in cognitive rehabilitation training and cognition assessment for neurodevelopmental disorders, brain injury, learning disabilities, and age-related cognitive decline. Welcome to the podcast, Amy.
Thank you, Dana.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, so as an educator and a psychologist now, you know, it's tempting to think that you know how to do everything for your own children as well, right? Mm-hmm. So it's so easy to give advice to other people about, you know, how to help their kids, but it's a little bit more difficult to think through all of the solutions yourself as a parent. And so when our youngest child, Evan, was in elementary school, I noticed that his spelling grades were always very low. He was a strong reader, but really struggled in spelling. And, you know, I would ask his teacher at every parent-teacher conference in first grade, in second grade, in third grade, are you concerned about the spelling? Are you concerned about the spelling? And they'd say, no, it's fine. He'll catch up. You know, I got different answers. And, you know, my master's degree is in early childhood education. And so I know what to do when a child is struggling with spelling, right? But I just trusted the system, you know, and really watched my child struggle with self-esteem issues as it got worse. And so at the open house that every school has, right, the first week of school, in fourth grade, I was standing in the hallway reading something that he had written about my husband, who was a military officer at the time. Mm-hmm. And so at the top of the page, he had written his name, Evan William Moore, and he spelled William, W-I-L-Y-U-M. And he went on to write, people salute my dad, S-A-L-O-O-T. So my fourth grader was spelling phonetically, like a first grader would spell. And I'm standing in the hallway of the elementary school and I burst into tears. And I remember thinking to myself, have I been so busy helping other people's children that my own has fallen through the cracks? And when I talked to him about it later that night, you know, I found out that he had been feeling dumb and defeated for a very long time. And so as a mom, it just breaks your heart. And then as an expert in this area, it broke it a second time. And so I specialize in cognitive training, and part of cognitive training is rehabilitating auditory analysis skills, those skills that are required for spelling, reading, and writing. And so I put him through 9 months of a brain training program with intense reading remediation. And so my child, who couldn't spell his own name in fourth grade, ended up in gifted and talented language arts in seventh grade.
Wow.
And at the end of eighth grade, tested into college ready English. And so at 14, he took college English 101 and 102 and passed them both with an A. Wow. So you talk about getting out of the trenches. I felt like I had redeemed myself a little bit as a mother by finally being able to address his needs. And that's what I do professionally. And so why wouldn't I do that for my own child?
But it goes to show he did have those capabilities, but, you know, discovering having that cognitive training, that retraining for him really helped. And I've had that same issue with my daughter who she's now in sixth grade, and she did spell phonetically probably until about fourth grade, and maybe not quite to that extent that you give the example of, but, you know, I think her turnaround is just developing a love for reading, and she's currently plowing through the Harry Potter books, right? And but she had that resistance for the longest time to sit down with a book. And now that's what she does in her free time. So that, you know, she realizes now it really helps her writing.
It took
until fifth and sixth grade, like, oh, okay, make those connections.
So. Right. Well, Evan's issue was he was a strong reader because he had memorized how words are spelled. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So he was getting by and falling through the cracks, mm-hmm. Because he didn't understand how to encode and decode. He was just memorizing.
So. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So tell me a little bit about some of the work that you do. So you have certain areas that you work with struggling learners, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's something called brain training for struggling learners that have ADHD, traumatic brain injury. So talk about how it's applicable to a myriad of issues that students might have.
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit about what brain training is. So brain training is very different than brain games, right? So mm-hmm. we hear about brain games all over the internet, you know, play these games and get smarter. And so when I talk about brain training, I'm talking about repeated engagement in targeted mental tasks mm-hmm. that are delivered by a human. So mm-hmm. you sit across a table and implement these tasks with a client one-on-one, like you would work out with a personal fitness trainer in the gym. Mm-hmm. You work out with a cognitive trainer for your brain. And so we have multiple cognitive skills that we use all day, every day in thinking and learning. So skills like working memory, long-term memory, attention, mm-hmm. visualization, our auditory processing skills that we just talked about, reasoning skills, attention skills. And so those are the skills that if we have one or two that aren't strong enough, that aren't working in concert with the other skills, mm-hmm. Can benefit from training. Mm-hmm. And then that strengthens our ability to think and learn. Okay. And so in my research, we've published more than a dozen articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals in the last few years. What we have found is that this intense, complex, human-delivered intervention can produce statistically significant changes in cognition and IQ score for children with learning struggles, children mm-hmm. with ADHD, adolescents and adults who have suffered a traumatic brain injury, and even older adults who are experiencing age-related memory and attention decline. So it's a universal intervention, and that's a really exciting message.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so would you say maybe for an adult who's had TBI maybe in their 20s, that there is some of this rebrain training that can be done for adults at that age to, they might not be able to return to their previous job, but they're able to get back more than maybe some of the doctors would say of their cognitive function? Because I know a family that's had a family member who's had a TBI. So how does that work with the TBI for adults?
Absolutely. So I recently told the same story. I gave a TEDx talk called Lessons Learned from Training 101,000 Brains. Mm-hmm. I told the story of a research participant who came to us 8 years after he had suffered a severe traumatic brain injury from a bicycle accident. Mm-hmm. And so he was in his late 50s at this point. Before the accident, he was a high-level engineer. Mm-hmm, and the accident was so severe that he had to learn how to walk and talk all over again. And he was not able to go back to work as an engineer. So he was working in more of a custodial type job for 8 years. Mm-hmm. He joined our research study. He went through 90 hours over about 6 months of intense, complex cognitive rehabilitation training. Mm-hmm. And he got his life back. Mm-hmm. He went back to the same engineering job at the same firm that he had been in 8 years earlier when he had had an accident.
Wow.
Right. And so it's just an example of the types of stories that we see all day, every day in our work. Mm-hmm. So yes, even 8 years after the accident, we were still able to harness the amazing capacity of the brain to change mm-hmm. with intense, repeated, engage experience. I mean, so that's neuroplasticity, and our brain is plastic throughout our lifespan, mm-hmm, capable mm-hmm. of being changed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it all depends on who works with that patient that's had the TBI, I think, and maybe some of the resources the family has access to. And I think the more we learn, you know, because the example I'm thinking about, the family that individual had a TBI maybe 15 years ago, right? And I mean, like you said, it doesn't matter if they had the injury 15, 20 years ago, you know, the brain's, you know, plastic and can be retaught, reworked, those types of things. So I'll definitely put a link to the TED Talk in the show notes. And I know a lot of parents, you know, when their child's struggling, tutoring's the first option they think of, but you have a little bit to say about tutoring versus brain training. So how could a parent, you know, have their student have maybe their brain retrained instead of necessarily doing the same old tutoring that doesn't always work?
Sure. So there is a time and place for both. Mm-hmm. So I want to say that up front. But there are two parts to SMART. There's what we know and learn. Mm-hmm. So English, math, social studies, all of the subject matter that we learn. And mm-hmm. then there's how we process what we learn. And so those are the cognitive skills that I just talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And so if your child is struggling in more than one subject, it could be because their processing skills need to be strengthened. Mm-hmm. So because their attention skills are not strong enough, or their memory skills aren't strong enough, or their reasoning mm-hmm. skills. So you could provide tutoring in every single one of those subjects, but if you're not looking at the root cause of why your child is struggling to learn, then mm-hmm. you're just going to continue tutoring and tutoring and tutoring and reteaching this information over and over again. And that could be an endless intervention, right? Mm-hmm. Because your child will not catch up. But if your child is only struggling in one subject, then a tutor mm-hmm. is probably the right choice, mm-hmm. right? It's just because maybe the instruction wasn't strong enough the first time around and they need help learning it again. Mm-hmm. But if you do see the struggles across subjects, then it is probably cognitive skills related. And so then what our recommendation would be is to go through a cognitive training program. And then for those older grades, particularly late middle school, high school, where a child has missed that instruction because their cognitive skills weren't strong enough yet, they mm-hmm. may still need some tutoring to help them catch up. But mm-hmm. once they've caught up, then they should be smooth sailing because they have strong enough cognitive skills to process the new information that they're learning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what would the age range be maybe to have the cognitive training? What would that, would it still be applicable for a high school senior in some cases, or would it be best for maybe upper elementary or middle school level students?
So it doesn't matter. We mm-hmm. train children as young as 4 years old,
okay.
And as old as 99 years old.
Okay.
So again, because this is a neuroplasticity based intervention, it can be used at any time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I know that there are a lot of people who think about learning styles, and when I think about learning styles, I think about visual, auditory, kinesthetic, but you have written about the myth of learning styles and what we should focus on instead. So tell me a little bit about that and how teachers create curriculum to address the learning styles instead of looking at how, you know, kids might have a cognitive learning difference.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
Sure. So we like to call the idea of learning styles a neuro myth.
Okay.
So it's one of the neuromyths that gets perpetuated, that everyone has a particular style of learning, mm-hmm. And that we need to create our lessons to meet each child's style of learning. So that's a mm-hmm. myth. Mm-hmm. Unless there's a brain injury or a deficit in hearing or vision, we're all capable of learning visually, auditorily, and kinesthetically. We mm-hmm. all have that capability. Now, we have preferences. So I may prefer to read to learn as opposed to listening to learn, and that's okay. And so if I have the opportunity to read the transcript rather than watch a video, I will. Mm-hmm. And some people would rather listen to a podcast than watch a podcast, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the bigger predictor of academic success is not creating curriculum that matches a learning style, but is that matches the prior knowledge of your okay. students. And so we have to, as teachers, say to our kids or assess in some way, what do you already know? Mm-hmm. What do you still need to know? And how can we find out? And the question in how can we find out is where kids then are able to suggest things that do match their preference, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, we could find out by reading, watching, listening, touching, right? Mm-hmm. And so to give that freedom is really good for motivation, mm-hmm. but neurologically is unnecessary.
Okay. Yeah. And so what would you say for teachers who are used to kind of learning, teaching, maybe starting out their school year and finding out learning styles, would you have them rather have students answer those questions about what they know, what they need to know, and how they can go about learning that, what they're curious about, kind of like a KWL chart?
That's exactly what I'm okay. saying is a KWL okay. chart. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And that I think that elementary school teachers in their teacher training programs learn about KWL charts yeah. all the time. We don't see that as much in teacher education in the secondary mm-hmm. level. And it's just as important. It's just as important to make that assessment, because you've got kids then at that point that are bored. They want to know, how is that going to be relevant to their lives? Why mm-hmm. do I have to learn this? And so when you do a KWL, and give them that option of saying, how can we find out, or how can we demonstrate our learning, then they're able to harness what those preferences are. But you as a teacher are not saying, okay, now I'm going to write this curriculum and these assignments to match each learning style. You can flip that mm-hmm, and give mm-hmm. students the opportunity to demonstrate their knowledge based on their own preferences. Mm-hmm, so it mm-hmm. takes pressure off the teachers.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So focus on assessment of prior knowledge, and then allow the students then to demonstrate their new learning mm-hmm, in a way yeah. that fits them.
Yeah. And I think that's, that was done by some teachers before the pandemic. But I think when everything was shut down 2 years ago, more and more teachers realized, okay, students can show that they've learned this concept by a variety of activities, which a lot of kids chose to make videos, right? Or things like that. So I think it's, finding out how can students best, show that they are competent in that area. So yeah, I think it's becoming more and more, I think, the norm. It's at the secondary level, but I'd like to see it more. I'd like to ask you a little bit about, as a parent, seeking some of these, learning a little bit more about brain science and just how students learn. But when we're thinking about a lens of connectedness, how do parents work with their children who might struggle with ADHD or ODD or any of those issues?
Yeah, so this is a topic that I'm super passionate about. And that's the parent-child relationship. Mm-hmm. And so whether your child has a diagnosis or has special needs or, is neurotypical, this idea of parenting through a lens of connectedness applies. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very simple idea of just saying, is the next thing that comes out of my mouth something that is going to strengthen the connection with my child or weaken the connection with my child.
Okay.
And if it's going to weaken the connection that you have with your child, then choose a different way of saying it or talking about it.
Okay.
And so we're busy, right? We're busy parents. We get frustrated. And so it's easy to just let something fly out of our mouths in terms of discipline, in terms of correcting our children. But our job as parents is to help our kids learn appropriate alternatives to an inappropriate behavior. And we can't do that if we shut down the connection. Right. And so when we tell a child, particularly a young child, no, we paralyze them.
Yeah.
So if we don't pair a yes with a no, then we're never going to be able to see that behavior change, right? Okay. We're going to say, okay, that child then interprets that as I'm not allowed to do that, but what am I allowed to do? And so just by adding, hey, it's not okay for you to do this, but you can do A, B, or C instead, right? And so then you've empowered them. You've given them choices and options, and then that has strengthened your connection with them because you're not just yelling at them, right? You're having just a loving, caring, teaching conversation.
Okay. Yeah. I think that is something I will take into account with a 6-year-old that, I sometimes have issues with in terms of, saying that no. And that I think, I've learned positive reinforcement always helps, but not always leading with the negative, as you said. I think, very, very important. And you have read and have also researched a lot about just anybody with ADHD. And I've seen a lot of just give an example of been watching The Amazing Race. And there's a couple, Penn and Kim, and they make YouTube videos. And he's around my age and he has ADHD. So he's very, very vocal for an adult with ADHD, right? So he's talking about how he has functioned on The Amazing Race as an adult with ADHD and how that has been both positive and negative in completing some of the tasks. So how does anybody with ADHD experience bigger emotions than neurotypical adults? And how can that be a positive in some cases, depending on the work they do or the tasks they have to do?
Sure. That's a great question. So I also have adult ADHD. I'll share this as a scientist and psychologist, but also as someone who experiences those big emotions. So one of the things that we see in ADHD that is not part of the diagnostic process, but probably should be, is this idea of emotion dysregulation. Okay. And so the ADHD brain is different than the neurotypical brain. We've seen that on every type of neuroimaging scan possible. And so, we know that the emotion center of our brain is the amygdala, guided by the hippocampus. And so those areas have less volume in the ADHD brain than in a neurotypical brain. And then the connectivity, the strength of the connections between the emotion center of the brain and the prefrontal cortex, which is our CEO of the brain, those connections are weaker in people with ADHD than in neurotypical brains. And so it's very common to see the amygdala hijack the regulatory center of our brain, our prefrontal cortex. And when the emotion center of your brain has taken over and you are unable to reason clearly because you're flooded with this strong emotion, then you can't regulate it. ADHD is an executive function disorder. And so when those executive functions are not working properly, when we don't have the ability then to regulate those, then we see just these floods of big emotions. It's interesting. Research has said to us that 98% of adolescents and adults with ADHD have something called rejection sensitive dysphoria.
Okay.
And that is the idea that if someone says something critical about us or rejects an idea that we have, or we feel like we've failed, then that emotion takes over and we are incapable of processing it. It will spin and spin and spin in our minds for days. It completely takes over. The ADHD brain isn't capable of distinguishing between a minor problem and a dangerous threat, right? So it's all big, right? Like everything that's wrong is big. And so when our brain and that fight or flight response interprets every minor problem as a dangerous threat, then you can imagine how we're not capable then of reasoning through the alternatives or the outcomes or the solutions.
Interesting to think about kind of, how a child with ADHD would react to that as being a big issue, or even an adult, and just learning coping skills and mechanisms.
Yes. And if you can, so there are a couple of ways that you can address that. If you can strengthen those executive function skills and cognitive training or brain training is one of those ways, then that's going to help, right? So that's going to help strengthen the connections between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex and strengthen those executive functions. So planning and attention and memory that we know are weak in ADHD. But cognitive behavioral therapy is also super important so that those of us with ADHD and big emotions can begin to regulate those as well.
So if a student often struggles more than others when it comes to school performance and they haven't been identified as having ADHD, ODD, or any of these other diagnoses, what should a parent do? Is it something they could maybe work with one of the brain centers like where you work, or, you know, get an assessment? Does this child necessarily need to have some type of these identifications to qualify for services? So kind of what where would a parent go in that situation?
Those are great questions. And so I would say both and. So yes, the school typically will take the lead on conducting a comprehensive assessment and will even, if they have a school psychologist, will even provide those initial diagnoses. A lot of times what happens is you'll see a child who is getting average grades, right? So they're not failing. And because they're not failing, but only performing at a C level, for example, that doesn't send up a red flag to the school. If you're getting C's, then the school system thinks you're all right. But you may be completely capable of getting A's with a little bit of help. And so those are the parents that are the most frustrated. The kids who are failing, the school picks that up right away, picks it up right away and says, let's evaluate them. Let's get them services. That's rarely an issue. It's that it's those kids in that middle section who are getting C minuses or D pluses that are falling through the cracks. The school's saying, it's all right. They're passing. They don't need anything from us. Those are the ones that would benefit from an external evaluation for sure. And yes, so our Learning Rx brain training centers around the country do cognitive assessments to identify if there are indeed some cognitive skills that need to be strengthened and could be the reason for the struggle in the classroom. And so that is not a diagnostic process. That's just saying, hey, here's the baseline performance on some cognitive skills. And this is what we see is associated with learning. And here's what we can do to help.
And if a parent were to contact one of these centers, is it covered by insurance? Do they have to pay out of pocket? Kind of how does that work?
Yeah. So just like tutoring, it is paid out of pocket at the centers. But learning disabilities are typically not covered by insurance anyway, regardless of the type of intervention. There are very few learning-related interventions that are covered by insurance, which is sad, but that's the reality.
Okay, good to know. Well, out of everything we talked about a myriad of just different things about what you, your expertise is and some of the research about behavior science. Out of everything we've discussed, what's one thing you'd like listeners to remember?
That we are not stuck with the cognitive cards we've been dealt.
Yeah, I think that's great to remember.
Right, we can improve them at any age. And so that's a message of hope.
Where can people connect with you and find you online?
So I am at amymoorephd.com and I work at LearningRx. So that's learningrx.com if they're interested in finding out more about brain training. And the research is under the research tab. So you can read all of the science that is behind this intervention.
Great. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes along with a couple of your articles and the TED Talk. And thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today.
Thank you, Dana. I loved being here.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.